Hey everybody, welcome to Mind Shift, the podcast that helps you to think critically about things like God, the church, and spirituality. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'm coming to you on a very rare sunny day here in North Wales on the Rock where I live with my wife Lisa, and I'm really happy to be bringing you part two of this discussion that I had recently with Dr. Hector Avalos on his book, The Bad Jesus, The Ethics of New Testament Ethics. And as I say, the aim of this podcast and my website, preachersforum.com, is to help you to learn how to think critically. What is it about thinking critically? What does it mean? One of my guests on a recent podcast I had, Mark Allen Shelsky, a while ago, made the comment that the church in North America is incapable of having a nuanced discussion about things like doctrine, the Bible, God, their faith, what things they believe, and so forth. And I think that's really true. And the aim of this podcast, therefore, is really to provide that nuanced discussion. That's why I'm happy to have Hector Avalos on here. If you listen to last week's, we started getting into a little bit of his story, what it means to be a new atheist, what does that mean, warning people about the dangers of religion, and specifically religionism. And I put a link to the New Atheist Manifesto on the show notes, as well as an article that I wrote, and I want to be producing some more articles on this interaction with the book, The Bad Jesus. And really, we get into it a bit more in this episode today. We talk about his book, and this is really the question that Hector Avalos poses in the book, is the question, could Jesus have done anything wrong? Could he have said anything wrong? Could he have acted in ways that perhaps today we would look at and say, you know, I'm not sure if I agree with that. And this is really a sacred cow, but it's all about thinking critically. Even if you disagree with what I'm saying or what Hector Avalos is saying, hopefully it gets you to think. And I think there's a couple of elements to this issue of thinking critically. The first aspect of thinking critically is admitting, first of all, that there are other divergent points of view out there. Not everybody agrees with the way you think and what you believe about a lot of things, whether it's politics, religion, or almost any subject. There are different points of view. And then the second thing is coming to it with a little degree of humility and saying, you know, not only are there different points of view out there, and they are different than mine, and people don't agree with me, but I can actually learn something. When I explore these with a bit of an open mind, I can actually learn something from these different points of view, and maybe it'll challenge some of your presuppositions. And really, that's what it's all about, because we find in this age of social media and news outlets online that, you know, people don't have to be exposed to different points of view if they don't want to. They can just find points of view that agree with what they already believe, what they already think, and just exclude those that they disagree with or just don't want to deal with. And you see this in the church, of course, as well. It's not unique to Christianity by any stretch of the imagination. So in this episode with Dr. Hector Avalos, I ask you to listen in with an open mind as we talk about the bad Jesus and some of the other discussion areas that we get into off of that kind of topic. I will say before we get to the interview in just a minute, the second half with Hector Avalos, I'll talk a little bit more at the end of the show about how you can get a hold of myself and Dr. Avalos on social media, and also how you can support the work of Mind Shift on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. So let's stop wasting everybody's time. Let's get right into it. We're going to start in with this topic of the bad Jesus, the ethics of New Testament ethics, with Dr. Hector Avalos right here on Mind Shift. Now, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about your book, The Bad Jesus. It's called The Ethics of New Testament Ethics. That's the subtitle. And I found it is absolutely fascinating. I haven't finished reading it. I'm about halfway through it at this point. I was going to say, you graciously mailed it to me from Iowa to over here in North Wales where I live. So I really appreciate you sending it over. I was reading it on the plane. We went on holiday to Italy recently, and I was reading it there and back on the plane. And I kept nudging my wife in the ribs and saying, "Look, you got to read this. This is quite amazing." So yeah, your book was being read on the plane. But one of the things I found fascinating, it's kind of the premise behind the book, isn't it? That you question this idea that, you know, where do we form our New Testament ethics from? This idea that Jesus never did anything wrong. He never said anything wrong. And you start from kind of that premise. And a lot of the scholarship around New Testament ethics kind of uses that presupposition, don't they? And then they sanctify it. They, you know, put him up on a pedestal. And I can see where that would be very hugely threatening to a lot of Christians, for sure.
So, yes, if you're actually doing historical critical scholarship, as many of them claim they're doing, then you should be studying a human being, not a divine being. And if you're studying a human being, the human being has to have flaws. I mean, I don't know any human being who's perfect. Why is it that you don't do that with Jesus? Well, because the answer is, they don't see him as only a human being.
Exactly.
There's still a major component that sees Jesus as divine somehow. And that has other bad consequences, which is you're not really allowing the text and the context to shine as well as they could, because you're suppressing a lot of what Jesus is saying in order to mitigate some of the things he said. So you're not really doing even good history, right? You're doing apologetics, and that's different.
Yes.
And so I go case by case with these titles like the hateful Jesus, the unloving Jesus, the misogynistic Jesus, where I try to show feminist Christian scholarship is really another form of male ancestor worship. You know, they proclaim liberation, you know, feminism, but they're really worshiping this man still as the paradigm. You know, how can that be?
Yeah.
And that's why Daphne Hansen is kind of a hero of mine. And I quote her, you haven't got right to that chapter. But,
not yet. I'm getting there.
She's from England. She's from the UK.
Oh, right.
But she and I lived in the same dorm at Harvard Divinity School for a while. And my regret is I didn't talk to her more then.
Luckily, you have social media later, and all kinds of other ways to keep in touch. Well, of course, the stock Christian answer, isn't it, to both the question of biblical literacy as well as this issue of the bad Jesus, it's got to be the default position that the reason that the Bible should be privileged is because it's inspired, it's the Word of God, and that's why. And Jesus wasn't just a human. That's the standard answer, isn't it? He was fully God, fully man. The classic that's the Orthodox Christian answer throughout the centuries, isn't it? I mean, they fought and you know, made creed, the Nicene Creed and everything else over these issues of the substance of Christ, wasn't it? He was fully God, fully man. You know, poor Arius got excommunicated over it and everything else, didn't he? Back in the 4th century.
I mean, there are a lot of real physical massacres, death battles throughout these Christological controversies. And I've been reading a lot about that period and how the ideas about Christology could get you killed, you know, whether if you didn't say Jesus is God in some cases, that was enough to kill you.
Yeah, and, exactly.
So it shows again that by saying God only reveals himself in this book, you're creating a scarce resource. God's communication is not universal. It's not in every book. It's only in this set of books. So that goes again to show how scarce resource plays into the creation of violence. You know, this is the only authority, you know, not every book is an authority, only this one. That's a scarce resource then.
Yeah, and one thing that strikes me reading The Bad Jesus is you say that you're kind of surprised and on some level to the extent to which religionism has permeated a lot of New Testament scholarship. You've got ethicists, you've got pacifists, feminists, as you say, who claim to be objective, historically objective, but actually, as you say, they're doing apologetic work. They're doing something other than, and they're calling it historic objective scholarship, but it actually isn't, is it? So as a trained scholar yourself, you're saying, wait a minute, you can't call it one thing but actually do something else to this ancient text.
Yes, exactly. So I kind of sometimes hear people say, you know, we kind of left the church behind. We're doing real history now. We're historians. And I, every time I read their work, you know, I see, no, you're doing theology and calling it history. You're not doing history. You know, you're doing theology. I mean, just imagine if at the SBL, we had people that said, we're doing Seussology. We're studying Seuss's real wishes and commands. And so we are studying these texts, these Greek texts, to find out what Seuss would want us to do. You know, you think, well, that's pretty bizarre. You know, why would you want to know what Seuss wants you to do by studying classical texts? Well, but most Christian scholars I see in the SBL constantly speak about, if we read the Bible right, we can discern, you know, the will of God, you know. Well, you don't do that in any other field that I know of. You don't do that in English. You don't do that in Greek literature. You don't do that in Roman literature. Why do you think you can do it in this field? So to me, you kind of have to go back to the history of theology in the academy. You know, in the Middle Ages, theology was at the top of all the disciplines, and then all of the disciplines served it.
It was the queen of the sciences, wasn't it?
Yeah. So slowly, it's been eroding. That's been eroding, and then somewhere in the late 19th century, the sciences came in and kind of supplanted the supremacy of the humanities. And now, you know, we emphasize scientific training. Well, theology still wants to be there, but it's just being called something else. So it's steadily losing its authority. And the only way to retain it is to pretend you're doing something else and calling it history or literature.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way you can retain its place in the academy. Once you look at the longer view of the history of theology, you'll see that it shifted to the idea that you could call it history and still do it. You know,
How much of what we're seeing today and what you're identifying in scholarship is as a result of this period of time? You say the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, you had the two kind of major streams that came out of that, didn't you? You had your classic liberal theology and your classic fundamentalist Christians who fought against the liberals. You know, they said they were eroding historic Christianity and you know, destroying the Bible with all their higher criticism, source criticism, form criticism, you know, demythologizing the text and all the rest of it. And surely that still has to be echoing down through the last, 50 to 100 years in the scholarship you're dealing with, isn't it?
Yes, and I have another book called The End of Biblical Studies that treats that whole stuff, including how jobs in religious studies are dying, you know, precisely because in public universities, religious studies is seen as religious, you know, not the study of religion or of religion, but like ministerial studies or something, you know, and a lot of people are saying, why are we paying for another scholar of the Bible when we need another expert in alternative fuels or, so slowly, actually, that whole mentality that you have had in biblical studies, religious studies, is actually counterproductive to religious studies. So I don't actually want to get rid of all Bible study. I think you should study the Bible. I just don't think you should privilege it. You know, reading the Bible is like you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, you read verses are needed, and you read the Bible. And as long as you don't have it as an authority for today, I'm fine with Bible study. You know, just don't make it an authority. You don't make Virgil an authority for today. You can learn from them, but they're not authorities, you know, in terms of we're going to set policy because of what Virgil said over here. You know, no one does it.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? And what struck me in reading through the Bad Jesus is it's kind of the cringeworthy efforts that some biblical scholars or ethicists go to preserve that image of Jesus. I remember one of the examples you talked about in one of the chapters about, you know, did Jesus promote violence? And there's the whole issue of him, you know, running these people out of the temple courts, you know, and making a whip. And then here's this one New Testament pacifist or ethicist saying, no, it wasn't really a whip. It was kind of more like some, you know, scraps of yarn, and he didn't hit anybody with it. Yeah, he only hit the animals. He, you know, if he did strike anything, it was the animals, and, you know, all the other guys just kind of went out peacefully, and he never got upset, and it wasn't violence, and, you know, it's explaining this stuff away, and yet you're saying, but just a plain reading of the text, it seems like he was upset, angry, he, you know, made an actual whip, and he was going around trashing the place, you know, and we don't seem to just give it a straight reading.
And then the other assumption in that episode is that, let's say he didn't even make a whip, they're still accepting the notion that he should have gone into that temple and you know, interfere with anything in there because he didn't regard it as proper worship. You know, well, you would never say that about anyone that came into your church and said, I don't like the way you're worshiping, and I'm going to overturn your tables, or I'm going to tell you off. You escort him out of the church, right? Yeah. But with Jesus, it's apparently, as long as he didn't commit violence, well, it's okay that he, you know, storms into your house of worship. Which to me is, it's probably the most common assumption that goes unexamined. They never think of the ethics of that. So as long as he didn't commit violence, it's okay if he storms in.
Yeah, he didn't get upset. Well, the other things that struck me about some of your conclusions, you talk about the stance against slavery, or perhaps the fact that Jesus and people like Paul didn't take actually a stronger stance against slavery, or Jesus, for example, healing people that were lame or blind. And the legacy of some of these things, or him assigning physical problems to demonic possession, you know, these have had a huge knock-on effect throughout the history of the church, haven't they? It's retarded medical science, psychology, because we've said, well, that person's they're probably demonically possessed. That's the root of their sickness.
And I speak as a former faith healer. I used to be a faith healer. And, wow. And I had people say, I was healed through your prayers. You know, so I was a faith healer from like age 7 to about, you know, first year of college. And I see the damage that it has done to people and my own family too. A lot of them forego medical treatment. They think, well, God's going to heal me. You know, I don't need to go there first, or I can wait. And then, you know, the problem becomes almost irreversible.
Yeah, this is a huge problem, isn't it? And I can certainly hear someone who might be listening to this episode thinking, you know, here's a person who's denying, you know, the classic deity of Christ. And you say, well, this is the crux of the whole issue. Either Jesus was suprahuman, and therefore there's huge implications if that's true, or he was just a human like us. And if that's the case, he must have had flaws like we all do, you know? So I can see where people would, certainly Christians, would get very upset with some of your conclusions. You're not going to be received with open arms probably at most of your local churches. But when I read the book, what strikes me about it is...
Can I interject? I have been invited to give a lecture on the Bad Jesus by my local Methodist church.
Right.
So there's a Methodist church in town. I gave them a lecture on religion and violence last year or the year before. And they said, well, can you come back? And I said, yeah, but the next book I have is The Bad Jesus. Oh, we want that book. We want to hear that. So there are some exceptions to that. You know, yeah. I've spoken to churches as a known atheist. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing that some denominations would welcome you in and want to hear your point of view, because so many would probably, you know, picket your demonstration, you know, and, you know, all the rest of it. We see that in America so much. It's such a polarized society, isn't it? And you can't separate religion and politics in America, can you? It's such a strange mix. You know, and this is obviously coming to the forefront again right now in the campaign of Donald Trump, as well as Hillary Clinton, isn't it? Because, you know, even though she was probably arguably more of a classical Christian than he ever was, she was vilified by so many different evangelical leaders. And, you know, where does this thinking come from?
Yeah, I've been writing for years about the death of classical evangelicals, you know, and how the term has become meaningless. It doesn't tell you much. I mean, and there are surveys by evangelicals themselves. The Barna group, for example, does research, social surveys, and shows, you know, how there is an increase in the acceptance of abortion, even gay marriage, even about among people that call themselves evangelical. So what would it mean then if I call myself an evangelical but accept a lot of these other practices that 30 years ago would be completely non-evangelical, right? They would not meet the definition of an evangelical. And certainly Trump would not.
No.
Trump doesn't know the Bible. He doesn't know the basic soteriology of Christianity. He has no interest in almost anything, but certainly not the Bible. He does not know the basics of being Christianity.
Yeah, what's so strange is that you see all these high-profile evangelical leaders surrounding Trump and, you know, praying for him. A week or so ago, we saw pictures of, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 high-profile evangelical Christian leaders in the Oval Office, laying hands on him, praying for him, supporting him, you know. And you have to wonder where – I always ask this question, you know, where is the evangelical church going to end up when all the dust settles from this presidency?
Yeah.
Surely they're going to be in a far worse place in terms of the culture wars. They think they're winning the culture war. But surely the battle's over. They've already lost. They just haven't admitted it yet.
Exactly. I completely agree with you. And it's not just my impression, but I mean, there are surveys showing the shift to more acceptance of gay marriages, more acceptance of cohabitation before marriage among self-described evangelicals. So it's not going to help them. I mean, you've had some kind of resistance and revolt even at Liberty University when Jerry Falwell Jr. endorsed Trump. Some of the students, you know, openly criticized. And so I find that these younger millennials are less religious. I believe the last statistics I saw was 28% or so of the class of, I think the fall of 14 or 16, would say they're not affiliated with any religion. 28%. And that's quite a bit. I mean, that it used to be almost negligible. But now it's sizable. It's over a quarter, nearly a third of young Americans saying, I don't practice some religion. I live in a neighborhood where some older people live. And no one on my block, as far as I know, the two to the south of me and the two to the north don't go to church. They're unchurched. I never at least see them go to church. And so I see it all around me, this decrease in at least formal religiosity. They may still have a lot of the belief, but this formal religiosity is seems to be dying, especially among the young. So
yeah. Where do you see sort of scholarship and slash the church? Because certainly in theological schools in North America, they're still clinging to this kind of model of, you know, we have departments, biblical studies and theological departments, you know, and there's still quite a lot of students going to these schools. So they're graduating and they're going somewhere. Where are they going and what are they doing? You know, what are they going to do? Where do you see this whole thing ending up in the next, you know, 20, 30 years? Where are we going to be in terms of scholarship?
Well, two things. I talk about it in the end of biblical studies a little more, but two things I've been observing is that seminaries, their enrollments are decreasing quite a bit. So actually on my Facebook page, on my timeline, I have a graph of the decreasing enrollments. And so that's one thing. So because of that, some well-known seminaries have closed or merged. You know, Andover Theological Union, Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge. They're closing or merging because they don't have enough students anymore. The second thing that's happening is shifting to online courses to get revenue. But shifting to online courses means you lack that previous social education you used to get by interacting with other people that are going to be ministered and so forth. So I have a few students, former students, who are in seminary. And one of them the other day on my Facebook page, actually if you go to the discussion in that graph post I have, she's saying, I live like in a ghost town in my seminary. They're online. people have gone online.
Yeah.
And it's trouble to go to campus. And, you know, why do that? And they're older, too, because not enough young people want to be ministers. It doesn't pay, right? So you're left with a lot of older people who want to maybe a second career. But the younger people, they're going to go into marketing. They're going to go into business. You're losing them. And so even if I never convince my fellow biblical scholars that biblical studies should end or will end, the demographics are against them. Demographics are against them in terms of there won't be enough people who know the Bible at all, even in seminaries. I have another friend at Southwestern, or an acquaintance at Southwestern, like one of the largest Baptist seminaries in the world. And he says, there's thousands of students, all right, but they're minimalist. They only want to come here and do the minimal work to get that certificate to do the ministerial work, to be a pastor. They're not really interested in learning a biblical language, which they diluted now. You know, you can take Greek and very basic Greek. You don't really use it. So if there are no people learning the biblical languages, learning the philology, learning the hardcore exegetical subjects.
Yeah. It takes a lot of work.
You're not going to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eventually, you're not going to have a biblical scholar. You're just going to have a whole bunch of people that talk about the Bible, but in a very superficial manner. That is not what an educated minister used to be. You know? When Harvard began, it started at a ministerial school. And you have to know Hebrew, Greek, and Latin to just go there. In fact, they didn't even allow English to be spoken at first.
Yeah.
You could not speak it. You know, these people are English only. No, it was Latin only. Right? You know, don't speak English.
The language of
that's
scholars.
That's not a good language.
Yeah.
People don't know that. You know?
It's true. You used to be, in the Middle Ages, wasn't it? Latin was the common language of scholars. You could go anywhere in Europe. Didn't matter if you spoke the local vernacular. If you could speak Latin, you could find somebody who could speak with you, no matter what country you were in. And that we've certainly lost a lot for sure, haven't we? Yeah. Well, listen, we're getting probably close to the end of the hour here. I'm really thankful though that we've talked about a lot of different things other than just biblical literacy and the bad Jesus. I mean, I would ask you though, in terms of your book, The Bad Jesus, what kind of audience is it sort of aimed at? I mean, it's a very detailed book, isn't it? You get really into language and historical, biblical studies. Who's sort of your target reader?
Yeah, my target readers are other biblical scholars. I pattern myself after, not that I am claiming to be as intelligent or anything, but after like a Newton, a Darwin, who wrote very technical work. They didn't write popular stuff because their work was aimed to get at the nuts and bolts of the field. You know, so Darwin spent years and years collecting data meticulously. And so I patterned myself after their work that in order to really challenge the biblical scholarship that is current, you need to show the technical competence and make the technical arguments for the other scholars who are going to read it. Because if I just write popular books, scholars aren't going to take you seriously. And so that's why I do what I do. I like to be very detailed. I'm trained as a philologist in Hebrew and Near Eastern and Semitic languages. And so I believe that you are no theologian unless you're a philologian, as A.T. Robertson, I think, said. And so that's what I do. And I find so much of, especially New Testament ethics, I have an appendix in The Bad Jesus about how often they quote these pre-Christian sources, and they hardly are familiar with, but not knowing those pre-Christian sources also means you think about a lot of what Jesus, this is new. You know, well, I can find it over in Mesopotamia like 1,000 years earlier, but it's because they're not reading that, that they don't realize it, you know. So just like one of the ones, my favorite is, Jesus was the first to preach love for your enemy. Yes. Well, that's true. That's just historically not true. And but how did you even get to that point where you thought that? Well, because you're training. You're not reading this ancient literature. You start with like Hellenistic and then Greek Greco-Roman, and that's it. And so I studied the indices of all these scholars' books and see what they quoted, you know, what they cited. Yeah. And that was a revelation to me that very few actually cited anything pre-Hellenistic when they're studying Jesus.
Yeah, there is certainly a bias as you identify in your work. There's this sort of thing, as you say, masquerading as objective historical scholarship. And yet, actually, it isn't. You know, we seem to put Jesus up on a pedestal. You know, he was an original thinker. He was the first one that said all these things. And it seems like we want to construct him in our image of what, you know, I think Richard Rohr says the worst thing you can do about Jesus is to start to worship him. You know, we put him up on a pedestal and we make him something other than perhaps what he really was. If he really was this historic person, surely he must have had flaws. But of course, as we say, the classic response is, no, he never sinned. He never did anything wrong. And it's circular logic, though, isn't it? It must be.
Yeah. Otherwise, I don't know of any perfect human beings in history. You know, every biography I read, you know, points out the flaws of Alexander the Great or
Napoleon,
even Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
So, to think Jesus was not a person of his time and of his context it seems to be the bizarre idea. Why wouldn't he be?
Why wouldn't he be? Well, I think we need to wrap it up. You're getting close to a good hour of discussion. I think that for anyone who's really interested in having their presuppositions challenged, I mean, what I appreciate most, I think I said this before about your work, is that this very careful scholarship, but you don't seem to have a bias or an agenda. You're saying, let's look at the arguments. Let's look at the evidence that you're citing for your position. And as you say, there's a lot of missing pieces there. And you're saying, but what about this and what about that? You're ignoring large elements of scholarship here. And that's very helpful. I don't, you know, even if you disagree with, maybe your conclusions, it's good. It's a good exercise in critical thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad. Thank you, and I appreciate. That's exactly what I want to hear when people read that book. So yes, thank you.
Yeah, and I think it's you've got to kind of get some emotional distance away. I think if I'd have read your book, you know, maybe 15 years ago, I would have been profoundly offended, you know, and said, this is the work of some, you know, there's a guy who's taking an axe to the root of the tree of Christianity and he wants to destroy it all. But when I read it, started it, you know, a few weeks ago, what struck me was, wait a minute, this is really challenging a lot of the things that I've just kind of taken for granted over the years. But then, you know, am I prepared to question it? And it's a bit disturbing because you think I was raised in a very fundamentalist church and I went to a conservative Bible college, conservative seminary. And now I look back on the methods of teaching, the way they taught me, there was very little critical reflection. There was no one thing I've really been struck by is that there was no understanding of the cultural conditioning of a lot of the doctrines of Christianity. They're historically and culturally conditioned. They come out of a context. And so they never talked about that. They just presented them as factual. God is this, Jesus is that. And I, the more I study the historic element behind how these doctrines came to be, I realize they were culturally conditioned, weren't they?
Yeah. And I started like you. I mean, I was raised in a Pentecostal fundamentalist family. And like I said, I believe in faith healing. I grew up reading Gleason Archer. I mean, all the classic apologists, you know. It was actually too much biblical literacy that made an unbeliever out of me.
Yeah, too much Bible.
The Bible made an unbeliever out of me. It's reading it. You know, it wasn't illiteracy. No, it was too much literacy.
Well, someone like Ed Stetzer would have a real problem with that because the more you read the Bible, the more you're supposed to become a better Christian. So obviously it didn't work in your case. Well, I think we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much, Dr. Hector Avalos, for taking the time to talk with me. This has been a fantastic conversation. I'd love to keep talking more, but now that we're friends on Facebook, we can certainly stay in touch. I was just going to say, how can people get in touch with you? What's the best way to get in touch with you if people wanted to chat and communicate?
Well, the best way is to write to my email address at my university, Havalos, and I just look at Iowa State, Hector Havalos, Iowa State, and you'll find it.
Yeah, well, I can put a link in the show notes if you want to put your email in there so you can get
in
touch with Hector.
I'll send you some more materials and links after this.
Okay, so we'll put it in the show notes. Thank you very much, Dr. Hector Havalos, for joining us for this discussion on biblical literacy and the bad Jesus.
All right, thank you so much, folks.
Well, thanks everybody for joining me here on Mind Shift with Dr. Hector Avalos in this second half talking about his book, The Bad Jesus, The Ethics of New Testament Ethics, and the new atheism, biblical literacy, and so many other topics. It's funny how he said that too much Bible made an unbeliever out of him. But my question to you, if you've listened to these two podcasts, is can you question what you think you know, what you think you believe? Because one of the things we've discovered in doing some of these other podcasts and talking to other people is that much of our faith, if you're a Christian or came out of Christianity perhaps, a lot of the things that you believe or you think you believe were actually inherited. They come out of a tradition. They come out of a theology. There's a story there. As I said to Hector Avalos, all doctrines are historically and culturally conditioned. I didn't come up with that. It was Dr. Stanley Grenz who said that. Every doctrine, every belief really in Christianity comes out of a historical context. It comes out of a historically conditioned context. And we need to examine those contexts and question whether or not we still believe some of those things. And do you have the freedom to question what you think you know and what you think you believe? And the reason we can question these things is because of people like Hector Avalos. And in his book, The Bad Jesus, he says, the problem that we have in a lot of what passes for historic Christian scholarship is circular logic. It's self-referential. He says all statements about God are ultimately self-referential. In other words, whenever we say something about God, whenever we say something about Jesus, it actually is saying more about ourselves, what we think we believe, or the God that we want to believe in, or the Jesus that we want to believe in. And we can make Jesus almost anything. We can make him a hippie, a guru, a loving teacher who dispenses wise words and original teaching, or we can make him a hate-filled Jesus of some of the other white supremacist groups, perhaps. Or we can make him the nationalistic Jesus wrapped in the flag of whatever country you want to surround him with and authorizing military strikes on other countries who disagree with us for whatever reason. So you can make Jesus, you can make God whatever you want. You can make him whoever you want him to be. And you hear a lot of this in churches. And can you question it? This is what I come back to. And that's the aim of Mind Shift. We want to help you to think critically about God, about the church, about spirituality, what you think you know, what you think you believe. So if you found this helpful or at least challenging, thought-provoking, I would love to hear your comments and feedback. You can get a hold of me on a variety of different ways and social media platforms. You can also get a hold of Dr. Hector Avalos. His email at Iowa State University is havalos@iastate.edu. So you can contact him, and I'll also put that email address in the show notes as well. All right, if you want to get a hold of me, there are a variety of ways you can do that on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at Preachers Forum. You can also send me an email if you still want to go that route, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can take a look at my Facebook page, facebook.com/The Preachers Forum. You can also find me on Instagram as well, at Preachers Forum. And then finally, if you found the work of Mind Shift helpful at all, you can support my work and what I'm doing for as little as $1 a month. You can go to patreon.com/Preachers Forum. And there's a little bit more information about why I started this podcast and how you can become a member of the Mind Shift podcast group on Facebook for a supporter reward. Finally, I just want to say as I sign off for this week that coming next Friday, I have a podcast that I did with my sister Valerie Cunningham, formerly Valerie Haycock, and we go into our past, our upbringing, growing up in a fundamentalist Christian home that was heavily influenced by the teachings of people like Bill Gothard and Dr. James Dobson, among others. And how did that shape us as children and even as adults? So if you are coming out of a Christian, evangelical, conservative, fundamentalist upbringing yourself, you are not going to want to miss the podcast that Valerie and I have for you next week. And I'm calling it Surviving a Fundamentalist Upbringing. So don't miss that episode next Friday with myself and my sister Valerie, who was just here visiting on vacation from the States. So thanks again for joining me and Dr. Hector Avalos. I will see you next Friday right here on Mind Shift.